Sweet comet Valentine, you make me smile with my heart.
We're listening to Chet Baker's classic version of My Funny Valentine, but if it sounds a bit unusual to you, well, that's because it's not actually Chet Baker who is singing. It's Ethan Hawke, the star of Born to Be Blue, a new biopic about the musician's struggles to remain clean and rebuild his career in the mid-1960s. The film received rave reviews when it premiered in last fall's Toronto International Film Festival, and Variety has praised Ethan Hawke's performance as one of the best of his career. It opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza Cinemas and the IFC Center, but right now I'm very pleased to welcome Ethan Hawke back to our show. Hi.
Well, thanks for having me.
In the movie, you not only sing like Chet Baker, you also have to look like you're playing the trumpet like him. What kind of preparation went into doing that?
Well, let's see. I had this, I don't know where to begin with that. But the most
effective... You had to learn how to finger and look like you
what I was
had
real
say,
embouchure.
Though,
there's a beautiful video that somebody took of Chet's last performance in live at Tokyo, which if you're a jazz fan, I really think it might be... It's certainly top five high watermarks of his professional life. It's an incredible performance, and you see his vocal performance, and you see the way he plays and the way he approaches it. And of course, he did different things at different periods. You know, he was sitting then, and earlier in his career, he would stand. And some periods, he'd wear sunglasses. Some periods, he wouldn't. And to play the trumpet, I started taking trumpet lessons. That's the place to start. And I gave myself the challenge of trying to simply... There were about eight songs that I was being asked to play in the movie. And so I started with one and tried to get as many of them as I could. No, luckily,
so are we actually hearing you on the soundtrack?
No, I can't. I mean, I begged my director to wait a year, to give me a year to practice. My trumpet teacher said if we waited 8 years, you wouldn't be ready. And so I realized that what I really just did is I learned the fingering, and I learned, you know, so the breathing and the embouchure and the fingering would be as right as possible, and I would just crank up the music, and I would just play along with it.
Did you watch Let's Get Lost, Bruce Weber's documentary
of course.
About Chet Baker?
I mean, I don't think I would know who Chet Baker was. I don't think this film would exist without Bruce Weber's Let's Get Lost. I think it turned my whole generation onto a guy that was largely forgotten at that moment.
Last time you were here, it was with your former piano teacher, Seymour Bernstein. So now you've been in two films about music? What are we to make of that?
You know, you could make it in Boyhood. I play a musician.
You sing in Boyhood.
I sing in Boyhood as well, and I played guitar and sang in Reality Bites. It's been a part of my life. I mean, the first film I directed, Chelsea Walls, my favorite aspect of the movie is the score. Jeff Tweedy from Wilco did the score, and if there's anything remarkable about the movie, it'd be, you know, really that score and perhaps Chris Christopherson, Tuesday Weld.
But in this, well, in Boyhood, your voice is much deeper than it is here. You had to sing in a different range here?
Yeah.
Because Chet was kind of a tenor.
Yeah, Chet's up here, you know. And for me, the challenge was, I don't think I probably would have had the guts to play this part if it weren't for Boyhood and Charlie Sexton. Charlie Sexton plays with Dylan, has been in his band for years, and is a beautiful musician. And we were asked when we completed Boyhood, would we record a couple of the songs that I'd written for the film? And so we went into a studio, and it was an incredible experience for me to be with a very serious musician, a very extremely talented person, and given permission to sing.
Well, it's living out a fantasy.
It really was. For me specifically. And shortly after that experience, this script fell on my table. And it spoke to me that maybe I could try to do it. Now, the problem is, of course, Chet sings several octaves higher than my range is at. And what I tried to do was lift my speaking voice through the whole part and just try to find a different range for myself. And I worked with a wonderful singing coach. I mean, the thing that's disarming about Chet, you know, when he was first playing, people would make fun of his singing, and it was not looked at seriously. But there is actually something really remarkable about it in its utter simplicity. And when you start trying to mimic it, you realize how difficult it is to be that easy, to be that effortless.
Well, people may have made fun of it, but in the late 50s, even people who weren't jazz fans had a copy of Chet Baker Sings in their record collections because it set such a romantic mood.
And I mean, I think that is why it sold, and that's why people like Miles didn't take him seriously.
Well, but people also made fun of Chet and said that if Miles, I remember, they would say, if Miles hadn't been born, Chet Baker couldn't have been born.
Well, he could have been born, but he wouldn't have played the trumpet.
But that was
the
joke.
That's the joke. I mean, there's great things people say. Chet Baker's like a shot of Miles poured in a, you know, in a crate of beer or something. You know, I mean, there's a really funny story. You know, how true it is, I don't know. But there's a story that when Chet won this Downbeat Magazine Trumpeter of the Year, he won him a couple years in a row, and he met Miles and said, you know, I really wanted to write you an apology letter when I got that. And Miles' answer was, there's 20 brothers you have to apologize to before you even get to apologizing to me.
Well, Miles was not the nicest person in the world.
No, no, no. When they were playing together at the Lighthouse, Miles refused to go on until they took Chet Baker's 45s out of the jukebox and broke them. But to show you Chet's point of view, see, Chet understood this, and he just smiled and said, can we play now? Like, he still just didn't want to lose the opportunity to play with Miles Davis. I mean, he himself would say that without the birth of the cool, he would have never been the player that he was.
And that's one of the records that you listed when the Times talked to you about your...
I didn't list that one just because I was trying to be more clever than that.
Although Birth of the Cool had Jerry Mulligan on it as well, and Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan...
Yeah.
Were a team for a long
time. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I put Blue Moods on because that's one of my favorite records, and just because it's lesser known. But yeah, Jerry Mulligan and Chet, they started the whole West Coast sound.
What traits do you think defined his personality? Because you had to get into his head.
It's hard to try to boil people into vocabulary words. You know,
would you describe him as weak? Because of the drug addiction?
You know, I don't think with a wagging finger like that, I feel it would be hard to really say that somebody who recorded that volume of music at that high of a level could be, you know, that their whole person could be defined by the word weak. He had an ethos that was a jazz ethos, and I think that his greatest heroes were Charlie Parker and Billie Holiday and Miles Davis, and he wanted to be an outlaw. And, you know, I mean, it's a funny interview I heard with him once where he was like, and I put this in the movie, that this person was saying that in this interview, well, you know, heroin killed Billie Holiday. He's like, heroin didn't kill Billie Holiday. Cops killed Billie Holiday. They'd let her take her medicine and give her club cards and let her play. Everything would be fine. And it kind of shows you his point of view of that situation.
Well, many musicians struggled with drug addiction at that time. Some said it was because they wanted to emulate heroes like Charlie Parker.
There's a strong case to be made that's true of Chet Baker. I mean, he got his break, as I'm sure you well know, through auditioning for Charlie Parker and being a part of that West Coast tour. And Charlie Parker was the great lion. If you loved bebop, I mean, that was his hero. And so that whole world was very seductive. Did he have weakness? He had a tremendous weakness. I mean, whenever I look at those beautiful William Claxton photos and I see that, those, you know, that personification of cool, you know, I look a little deeper and you wonder who wants to put themselves off like that, you know, and how that there's any, all of my experience in the artistic community tells me with that kind of confidence and with that kind of bravado runs hand in hand with powerful insecurity.
In one scene, Chet's manager, Dick, posits that everything came so easily to him.
Well, until he lost his teeth.
Yeah. In fact, he in the Bruce Weber film, he sings "Blame It on My Youth," but because he doesn't have any teeth,
it winds up like blame it on my use.
I know. Which sounds like he... I wonder if he was conscious of it.
Yeah, he was probably. I don't know. I mean, we put in this movie "I've Never Been in Love Before" and use it in a very different context than I think the song's initial intent was to be used. And that's the mark of a great song.
Now, in this, well, first of all, I should tell people my guest is Ethan Hawke, who stars as Chet Baker in a new film called Born to be Blue, which opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema and the IFC Center. But some of this is fictionalized. For example, Jane, his chief love interest throughout the film, is is a composite character?
The whole movie is fictionalized. I mean, basically every biopic you've ever seen in your life is fictionalized. And one of the things that made me want to do this movie is the way the film starts, the way the script started, it's magical in a way, which is it takes one true fact that Dino De Laurentiis approached Chet Baker and asked him to star as himself in a movie version of himself. Well, this filmmaker imagines that that happened.
But he was asked to star in a film about himself because one of the main reasons for his appeal is he was really handsome.
He was a beautiful
man.
And
he looked kind of like James Dean.
Yeah, and the idea was that he could play himself. Now, Chet...
But Chet said no to that.
He said yes to it, but it never happened. He blew it and he couldn't show up. But didn't, you know, that was not going to work into his lifestyle. But this filmmaker imagines that it had. And by doing that, even the film never took place, though. The film is more of a reimagining of the legend or the myth of Chet Baker than it aspires to be any kind of factual accuracy. It's almost, the director used to have this expression or way of looking at it that I liked. You know, the way jazz musicians will take a standard, a Gershwin tune, Cole Porter tune or something, and just riff on it and change it and shake it, but it'll be based on these certain fence posts that they will find and stick to. Well, in a large way, we're taking the myth of Chet Baker and we're just kind of running with it. It's as if you listen to five albums in a row, you close your eyes and sat in a room one Sunday afternoon, this is the movie that would come to you. That was our aspiration. That it's not... If you want the facts, you can Google him right now and you can see hours of beautiful interviews and beautiful music. That doesn't make a great story. You know, I mean, Raging Bull, to my mind, is always the great high watermark of a film depiction of a person's life. You don't need to know who Jake LaMotta is. You don't need to know anything about boxing. Boxing works as a metaphor, and it becomes a larger story. In much the same way, our aspiration is to use the life of Chet Baker to dream on a story that might be relevant to other people in other people's lives.
I don't want to reveal any spoilers, but... in the film, it's made clear that Chet Baker never really managed to get clean, although he tried many times, and wound up living in Europe until his death. But in an odd way, it's a kind of a defense of, well, if you're a heroin addict and it makes you happy, why not just keep on taking it?
Well, there's that thought. There's a line in the movie.
There's a new movie called about heroin, and kind of comes to the same conclusion. A documentary.
Well, that's a kind of, it's a weird way of looking at it in a way, because heroin's kind of like a, it's a funny, there's so many things I want to say about that. There's a great letter exchange between Allen Ginsberg and William Burroughs, and Allen Ginsberg is talking about exploring enlightenment and how to find, you know, truth and detachment and, you know, all through all these Buddhist exercises and meditations, that was making him much happier and making him a much more centered being. And William Burroughs says, I can buy that for $10 on 11th Street, you know. And it's a shortcut around a mountain, because Chet Baker, Charlie Parker would say things, you know, like, I never hurt anybody but myself. But the thing is that we don't live in a vacuum, that you can't hurt yourself that continually, that often, without hurting a great many of other people. Anybody who loves you, your children, your brothers, your sisters, your mother, your father, your wives, your lovers, right? If you have no self-respect and you don't want to take care of yourself, it does hurt people. And you have to take some responsibility to that, that there's a massive amount of selfishness to put your own pursuit of pleasure and inoculating yourself from life's the vicissitudes of life, as it were, right? You know, the part of the struggle...
And that's one of the themes of this film.
Yeah, it is. I mean, did Chet Baker play better stoned? He played very well high. He played very well when he was sober, too, you know? I mean, early in his career, before he ever tried heroin, it was some of his finest work, as was some of the end of his life. So it's a little mysterious. But for me, the answer is not, how does it affect your art? It's, who are you? Who do you want to be? And what kind of life do you want to have? And for me... If you're willing to destroy yourself in service of your art, you're not really servicing anything. Because if you want to service the art, you want to live a long time. Look at Willie Nelson. Look at Dizzy Gillespie. Look at people who did take care of themselves, who have a sense of joy and a sense of purpose. Their candle burns twice as bright. You know, their contribution is, you know, so I don't really buy it. It makes for an interesting drama. Like if you set yourself on fire, it's interesting to watch. But it doesn't make for a great life.
You have another film coming out also with Greta Gerwig?
I do.
What's that about?
It's called Maggie's Plan. It's Greta Gerwig and Julianne Moore, and it's a comedy. So if you don't find the jazz kind of milieu interesting, we can lighten up the evening for date night.
And also another book?
I have a graphic novel called Inde, which is about the Apache Wars that I've been working on for years with an artist, Greg Ruth. It's going to come out in June, and I'm really proud to even be associated with Greg's art.
I mentioned that a lot of musicians became drug addicts because they want to emulate their hero, Charlie Parker, who at one point kicked and said, well, gee, I play a lot better when I'm not stoned. But that's beside the point. What about young musicians who not only see Chet Baker, but also Amy Winehouse, Jimi Hendrix, and so many others? And
Hank Williams, yeah. You know, the list is long. I was in here for this documentary I did, Seymour, an introduction about Seymour Bernstein. And one of the things that I love about Seymour is in Amy Winehouse, you see a wonderful young woman, you know, set herself on fire and let her demons control her life and take them right into the gutter. With a man like Seymour, you see how to live with your demons, how to channel them, how to turn it into a beautiful life and a substantive life for other people. And I find that really exciting. I've had mentors in my life, whether it's the theater director Jack O'Brien or the playwright Tom Stoppard, people whose lives continually evolve. And they don't stop at one plateau with their talent. They keep asking their talent to grow. And it's really inspiring to be around. And the thing about any kind of alcohol addiction or drug addiction, drugs, alcohol, or any kind of addiction is when you kind of freeze dry yourself, you're trying to kill the pain, and it's a painkiller. But you do kind of put yourself in formaldehyde and stop growing. That a lot of times that without any pain, we wouldn't grow at all. And I'm not saying that there are healthy ways to manage your pain. And, you know, I found Allen Ginsberg a real hero, and I think that he walked the hard way around the mountain. And I think he wound up somewhere. When he got there, he was awake, you know.
Ethan Hawke stars as Chet Baker in Born to be Blue. It's currently it opens tomorrow at the Lincoln Plaza Cinema and the IFC Center. And I thank you so much for being on our show. Let's listen to a little of the real Chet Baker
as we
go out.
That'd be so wonderful. What are you going to play?
Same, My Funny Valentine.
Okay, let's hear it.
My Funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine, you make me smile.